Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics investigator who has been crusading against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic and doing so very heroically for a number of years. Mike is the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter, an excellent read, and something that gets the Dave Emery five-star rating. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Always a pleasure, David.
Now, we've been talking about someone who was very much in the news in the early 1980s and then faded, and that was Edwin Wilson, a man that, as I like to say, had more connections in a switchboard. And before we get to, I want to review what happened to Elaine Boatner and the chronology with Sporkin and Turner for the purposes of clarity and refreshing here at people's memories. But when the Wilson cases came to trial in the early 1980s, a lot of people bit it, people like Kevin Mulcahy and others. I wonder if you would revisit that for us.
Well, one of the, in the what I call the cover story, David, for how Wilson was brought to trial, and I do believe it was a cover story. And as part of my current investigation, I've actually interviewed Peter Moss, who wrote the book Manhunt. I had a very interesting conversation with him. There was one guy who had worked for Ed Wilson at one point, who was fairly young at the time. His name was Kevin Mulcahy, his father a retired CIA executive. Kevin was a bona fide, full-blown alcoholic. Who had a severe drinking problem, also had one leg missing, went to work for Wilson, kind of had problems with stability, but he got involved with many of Wilson's schemes. And Wilson was not just on one occasion shipping C4. Wilson had an ongoing relationship with Libya. He was running training camps, selling weapons, machine guns, M16s, anything he could get his hands on, uniforms, desalinization plants to Egypt. Wilson was just kind of like all over the map all the time. And Mulcahy was working for him. Now, ostensibly, Mulcahy came across plans to train the Libyan forces to make these bombs with the C4, and that caused him some discomfort. So he started calling around, and he actually called Ted Shackley, was put through to Ted Shackley, called CIA, called the FBI, started making noise, and some courageous BATF investigators picked up on Ed Wilson's scent at that point, which was probably the beginning of his downfall, that and his monumental ego. But actually, Kevin Mulcahy did not die until after Wilson had been convicted on a number of crimes. He was found in a Virginia motel room with a case of 12 empty wine bottles, and he was wedged in the middle of winter in between the screen door and the door to his motel bungalow, with his pants down around his ankles, and he was dead and kind of half frozen to death, and although he didn't have a large amount of alcohol in his system.
He also had been, this is one of the important ones, he'd been expressing fear for his life.
Oh, for a long time.
And I think he had actually, as I recall, shot out either the window or the door of his cabin with a shotgun in response to something real or imagined.
Yes.
And, of course, we should note that there are all kinds of ways in the intelligence community of executing someone in such a way as to make it look like natural causes. And, in fact, when Mulcahy died, one of the Green Beret who had been working for Ed Wilson expressed fear for his life, saying that basically there, you know, he knew how this kind of thing could be done, and he was scared. One of the things that's mentioned in a book, I think it's called Deadly Business. It's about Sam Cummings and the CIA, which also at one point touched on the Wilson case. Mulcahy claimed to have seen Carlos the Jackal rubbing elbows with Frank Turple on a yacht, and that's when he began to realize that all was not as it was being portrayed.
Yeah, and it was also kind of suspicious that Frank Turple was doing a lot of business with Uganda's Idi Amin, not exactly known for his mental stability either. Amin was, of course, a very, very bloodthirsty guy who liked, you know, having the heads or tongues or various organs of his opponents mailed home to their families.
Mm-hmm. The a couple of anti-Castro Cubans who'd worked with Wilson, too. I've forgotten whether it was Raul or Rafael Villaverde, and also Ricardo Monkey Morales.
And Rafael Chichi Quintero as well. Yeah.
That's right. Rafael Chichi Quintero also bit it around this time. Or no, was Chichi, did Chichi Quintero die at that
Chichi
time?
Chichi did not die at that time.
Okay.
But he was afraid for his life.
That's because he later figured in Iran-Contra.
Yes, he did, very much so.
And but Monkey Morales died around that time, and so did one of the Villaverde brothers, who was apparently blown up in a yacht that he had. So
there's no doubt about the fact. I don't think anybody will dispute that Edwin Wilson is a killer and had been trained to do that. And, you know, there's a school of thought that says, well, that's what those kind of CIA guys do. I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that Wilson had that capability. He was subsequently convicted, and it was a very clear-cut conviction because they had tapes of Edwin Wilson conspiring to hire a hitman to kill the Justice Department prosecutors, Larry Barcella, Ted Greenberg, and others,
mm-hmm.
who had secured his first two convictions in Alexandria and in Houston. So, Wilson is not a guy you would necessarily want to take home to meet mom.
He was a paymaster at the Bay of Pigs, an individual with a long history, had been involved with the U2 project. So this is a guy also who knew where a lot of the bodies were buried.
That's true,
and probably buried more than a few himself.
Absolutely.
We should also mention that not only Wilson would have had a possible motive to kill people, and he certainly was convicted of plotting that, but there was obviously much more to the Ed Wilson case than we were told, and there were higher powers that also had certainly motive to keep the Wilson case covered up, and perhaps cover up a few of the people who could have provided information as well. I mean, literally covered them up with earth.
That's the crux of what is so huge now and why it may potentially have even a devastating effect on the presidential campaign.
Again, briefly review Elaine Boatner and the chronology with Sporkin's resignation and Stansfield Turner's plane crash.
Well, I have to give you the history first, but okay, let me do this. Let's just say that on the 12th of January, Helene Boatner, 65 mm-hmm. years old, retired comptroller of the CIA, who had been involved in operational programs for CIA. She was no clerk, who had also served as a special advisor to Madeleine Albright, died very suddenly and what I think very suspiciously in a scuba diving accident in the Bahamas in clear water, where she got separated from a group of fellow scuba divers and then was suddenly found later drowned under some rocks. Very bizarre. That was the 12th. On the 14th or so, which I'm not looking at a calendar, but it was Friday.
That was the 14th, yeah.
Judge Stanley Sporkin, Washington, D.C., United States District Court, who was the retired general counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency, who had been involved deeply with Wilson's Houston conviction, retired suddenly from the federal bench, and he is one who stands very much exposed on the current case. That was Friday, and on Saturday, the 15th, Admiral Stansfield Turner, Jimmy Carter's director of Central Intelligence, who had started several internal investigations of Edward Wilson, who would likely have been called to testify in Wilson's new motion to set aside his conviction, was nearly killed, and his wife was in fact killed in a plane crash in Costa Rica, which is still under investigation. And I have seen a number of wire service photos of the crash. The plane was not brought down by any missiles. It crashed apparently because of engine failure shortly after takeoff. There is no fire damage anywhere on the aircraft. But witnesses say that the plane just lost power and started fishtailing soon after takeoff, and it was loaded with a number of people. And it was a Checkmate turboprop. Now, sadly enough, the black box is being sent to Czechoslovakia.
Well, I'm sure they're fascinated with the story.
And we won't see it for 6 months.
You mean the Czech Republic? This is funny. The world has changed so much. There is no more Czechoslovakia.
That's right.
It's the Czech Republic now.
The Czech Republic.
Right.
That's correct.
Well, that's certainly a good place to send the black box.
But now you have to know why all of this happened.
Right. Now, in your the most recent, I guess this is not the one that's coming right out, but in the November and December of 1999 issue of From the Wilderness, you update the Wilson story and talk about an affidavit that has been secured by his attorney, Mr. Stephen Adler.
David Adler is the
David
attorney.
Adler, excuse me.
That's all right. It wasn't an affidavit. What secured Ed Wilson's conviction, and this is amazing, okay,
mm-hmm.
is that on February 3rd, 1983, in Houston, as Wilson was on trial for charges of sending the C-4 to Gaddafi, Wilson's defense had rested, and his defense was that the agency knew what I was doing. The agency approved. The agency went along with it. And he raised a pretty decent defense to the point where a lot of prosecutors in the CIA were extremely nervous. On February 3rd, 1983, in Langley, Virginia, I have the records attesting to this, at something like 2:15 p.m., the number three man in the CIA, Executive Director Charles Briggs, signed a declaration or affidavit stating that at no time, after an extensive search of CIA records, all components of the agency, Charles Briggs had determined, looking at CIA records, that at no time after 1972 had Edwin Wilson either directly or indirectly provided any services directly or indirectly for the Central Intelligence Agency. He absolutely had no contact with CIA. Approximately 10 minutes, 5 minutes later, that affidavit was notarized by the General Counsel of the CIA, Stanley Sporkin, who affixed the seal of the Central Intelligence Agency to the document. It was then notarized in Langley, Virginia. It was submitted into evidence as rebuttal for Wilson's defense on the 4th of February. Late in the afternoon on the 4th of February, the jury began their deliberations. On the morning of the 5th of February, 1983, the jury came out and asked to have only one piece of evidence out of the whole trial reread, and that was the Briggs affidavit, which was then reread. An hour later, the jury emerged with a guilty verdict. Subsequently, one of the jurors gave an interview to Associated Press, I believe it was, and said, that affidavit convinced us. We thought he was working for CIA, but that, you know, we had some holdouts, but they went away because of the CIA affidavit.
Just one second, Mike. Okay, go ahead, Mike.
All right, so what was not known at the time and what is now part of a once classified secret memorandum in CIA, memorandum for recollection, is that on the night of February 3rd, right before the affidavit was submitted into evidence, the CIA was calling the Justice Department prosecutors and saying, don't use this affidavit, it's flawed. I mean, we really shouldn't say indirectly. Stanley Sporkin was adamant, actually, and all along, Deputy Attorney General Mark Richard, who I've also talked to for this story, was expressing concern. And there was a big wailing and gnashing of teeth the night before this affidavit was submitted. It was clearly incorrect. I mean, we are now in possession of, it is abundantly evident. I've got 900 pages of documents here showing that Ed Wilson had more than 80 non-social contacts with the agency that are documented after 1972. I mean, the agency's position there was so flawed as to be absolutely unsustainable. But the lead prosecutor in Houston, Ted Greenberg, who most recently was the special counsel, the independent counsel prosecuting Mike Espy, was adamant that even knowing that it was flawed, he was going to use it anyway. Now,
that, of course, has very questionable legal basis.
Well, there are several rules in criminal procedures. First of all, you just can't submit anything that's perjured if it's not true. Period.
Right.
And it is abundantly clear from the documentation that even Stanley Sporkin, the CIA's general counsel, knew that the document on its face was not true. Yet it was used anyway. You had a number of high-ranking figures in the Justice Department who apparently went right along with the program, not only during its submission, but immediately after, because Wilson was convicted on February the 5th. He was sentenced on the 17th, and there is now, thanks to Freedom of Information Act releases to Ed Wilson's lawyer in Washington, who was Bernard Fensterwald, who is not representing him now at trial, about 300,000 pages were released. I should add parenthetically, and you will appreciate this, during or under the stewardship of President Bill Clinton, a Democrat who was controlling the Justice Department allowed these documents to be released to Wilson, which hurt Republicans. It's a mm-hmm. very Clintonian move. There's 1,000 pages of documents here which show the mental, legal, rationalization that these major figures in the United States Department of Justice went to justify their position. They said, well, he didn't perform operational services. Well, if you read these other documents closely, ATF showed clearly that CIA was telling Wilson employees in Libya to gather intelligence and gather Soviet equipment. So that's operational tasking under Wilson's company, Aegis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys step all over themselves to not tell the truth and to imply that, well, Wilson knew about this, he didn't challenge the affidavit. And, of course, having studied covert operations for a long time, I can tell you exactly why. Wilson was a fabulously wealthy man because he was deniable. He was the place where the chain was going to be cut, and he knew it. He made millions of dollars and lived the life of Riley, but he knew that the agency was not going to back him up if he got caught.
Right. It was like Mission Impossible.
Right.
Very much.
Right. And, you know, he knew that he couldn't call Ted Shackley to the stand, and Ted Shackley's role is deeply in question, by the way. Shackley was questioned by a grand jury, and I am now in possession of notes by some of these powerhouse judicial figures saying Ted Shackley lied to grand jury.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Mike, we have about a little over 10 minutes. If we could briefly run through the list of characters that you call the Magnificent Seven.
Okay. First, we will take Ted Greenberg, who was the lead prosecutor, so to speak, in Houston, who was really calling the shots vis-a-vis CIA, and who, according to the CIA memorandum, absolutely insisted upon using a document which he knew to be inaccurate and which CIA was objecting to. Of course, what's interesting, too, is why CIA rolled over for an assistant U.S. attorney. Ted Greenberg is now a very powerful guy in Washington, an independent counsel who just prosecuted Mike Espy. We have Larry Barcella, who I spent more than an hour interviewing today, who was kind of the legendary prosecutor in the case. He was the hero of the book Manhunt by Peter Moss. He was the guy who also secured convictions in the bombing assassination of Orlando Letelier. Barcella is now an extremely powerful lawyer in private practice in Washington, who went on to become, I should add, very closely affiliated with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, and members of the Reagan administration during Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
We have D. Lowell Jensen, who was Assistant Attorney General when Wilson was being prosecuted. Lowell Jensen came up the legal ladder from the Alameda County District Attorney's Office with Edwin Meese, another great hero that you and I would love to pick on, a very dirty guy. Lowell Jensen is now a sitting United States District Court judge in Oakland, California. Mark Richard, who was one of the Justice Department's point men on Waco, was a deputy assistant attorney general then, who had a lot of hands-on involvement with the Wilson investigations, and was very involved both before trial and after trial in discussions about this flawed memorandum.
Mm-hmm.
We have Stephen Trott, who was also an assistant attorney general, very involved in Iran-Contra, who is now a sitting judge on the United States Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He lives in Boise, Idaho, where he sits, renders his judgments from up there. He too, is exposed on this memorandum. We have Carol Bruce, who was recently the independent counsel who prosecuted, I believe it was Bruce Babbitt in Arizona, on Indian gaming.
Mm-hmm.
We have, how many is that? Did I get six or seven?
Carol Bruce, I think you've got just about all of them. We've got Barcella, Richard, D. Lowell Jensen, Stephen Trott, and the aforementioned Stanley Sporkin.
Okay. Now, here's the deal. There was one of the documents that Ed Wilson found out of these 300,000 pages. He's now in Allenwood, Pennsylvania, of course, was a memorandum written immediately after the conviction by Carol Bruce to Deputy Assistant Attorney General Mark Richard, saying, and it was titled, Duty to Disclose Possibly False Testimony. And it is the mother of all smoking guns, because it indicates clearly, it's about a five-page memorandum, how all of these lawyers in the Justice Department knew that that memorandum was flawed. It was possibly, you know, it was likely perjurious. You might have to put it to a jury, but, you know, if you lie under oath, that's perjury, okay? And they knew they were lying. And there was a great deal of concern, and this memorandum surfaced. And it was the subject for very intense debates, and the paper trail which followed is huge. And the bottom line is this. Ed Wilson is not a good guy. But it is very clear, based upon the way his conviction was handed down, that the jury rendered a verdict, and what was foremost in their mind at that time was a document which the Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency knew to be flawed, but it was essential that they secure the conviction at that point to protect everything else.
Now, this brings us up to date on the information from the last, from the Wilderness Newsletter, the November and December 1999 issue. You have been working on the Wilson story, and in the 7 or 8 minutes we have left, what can you tell us about what's coming in the, what's going to be forthcoming in From the Wilderness and what you've been working on recently?
Well, we have worked extensively with Edwin Wilson's lawyers, and I have reviewed all 900 pages in the court filings by Wilson's lawyers. It's some incredible documentation. I'm actually going to be reproducing some of these documents in the newsletter. I have conducted a number of interviews, and you will be hearing, and if you know my personal story, it was something for me to get an interview with Ted Shackley, which I did. He didn't say much, but I got an interview. I will give you one funny quote from Ted Shackley about Stansfield Turner's air crash, which I'm sure you will appreciate. As I asked him if he had any observation on the air crash, he said, "Well, it sounds like one of those regular airplane crashes to me, one of those offbeat airline kind of things."
Well, that it certainly is one way of characterizing it.
I have interviewed Larry Barcella extensively. I actually got through to Stephen Trott and to Mark Richard, who has suddenly transferred from his offices in Washington to Brussels, where he's working at The Hague and on NATO issues, very surprisingly. And we caught him totally by surprise, and this case apparently caught him by surprise. We will hopefully have had, I should have an interview with Edwin Wilson himself before I go to press, but if not, that's definitely on the burner. But I will actually lay out in this newsletter exactly why this case is one which has probably everybody in Washington now on the edge of their seats going, the S word, what's going to happen if Wilson gets a new trial? Because the Department of Justice is really on the horns. The government went out of its way to vilify Edwin Wilson, to make him an evil guy. If Wilson gets off on this charge and is not retried, the Justice Department's got a lot of splaining to do, Lucy. If, on the other hand, Edwin Wilson gets retried, then you will see Ted Shackley come to the stand, and you will see questions asked about George Bush's directorship of the CIA. And I should tell you that it is Ed Wilson's attorney, David Adler's, intention to subpoena not only all seven of these individuals that I've just named to you to the stand, but also Ted Shackley. And Stan Turner was probably on that list, although his ability to testify now is somewhat in question.
Since he decided to fly Icarus Airlines down in San Jose.
Yes.
And apparently got too near the sun. Now, is your take on why this is happening now? That's one of the things that I've wondered about. Now, you've just perhaps given us a clue in the sense that this will conceivably bear on the upcoming presidential election since we've got Shrub Bush running.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that had anything to do with dictating the timing?
I absolutely do. First of all, let me just say that in the canon of legal ethics, it is absolutely unjustifiable that any attorney or any officer of the court would allow a perjured affidavit or inaccurate affidavit to be admitted into evidence. It violates the Brady rule for disclosure of exculpatory evidence. It violates any number of rules. But it is a crime which was committed every day that all of these people remained silent for all of these last 17 years while Wilson was in prison on the charges. So these guys can't get off on this. Now, it is one of those non-collateralizing issues which in politics are so prized, and I've mentioned this like with regards to Iran-Contra. Clinton has a hard time bringing up Iran-Contra drugs, although he did in his impeachment, as a doomsday weapon because it collateralizes to him over the issue of MENA, Arkansas. However, this issue does not collateralize to Bill Clinton because it occurred in 76-77 and doesn't run into Iran-Contra. It involves nothing but major Republican appointees, and those who are Democratic guys, like Mark Richard, is absolutely at the end of his career. He's an elderly guy. Easy to go, but wouldn't William Jefferson Clinton love, before he leaves the White House, to appoint 3 new federal judges, including 1 to the Circuit Court of Appeals? What a legacy for Bill Clinton. What a last hurrah. Also, if this hits the press around the time that the primaries are heating up, It sheds a direct spotlight onto the stewardship of CIA and the activities of George Herbert Walker Bush.
And, of course, now his son is saying that he doesn't want to be held accountable for anything his father has done. And yet, the latter part of his father's administration, he was deeply involved with what his father was doing.
Yes, and, you know, I'm sorry, boy, you can't have your cake and eat it, too. You can't, you know, the knife has to cut in both directions.
Yeah, and of course, in the persons of people like James R. Bath, hooked up with BCCI and CIA, and Arbusto Energy, and the Bin Laden family, we have some hard operatives involved with W's situation who trace back to the father's shenanigans.
Yes.
So heads may roll, and in fact, heads probably will roll. It's a question of whose head and in which direction it'll roll.
And when, that's correct.
Yep.
But I think we should all keep our eyes out on the news wires for any coming accidents involving former CIA officials.
Yeah, it certainly, that's why I wanted to go into the stuff about Mulcahy and some of the others, because this has a numbing familiarity to those familiar with the chronology and mortality around the Ed Wilson cases. Mike, in the last couple of minutes here, if you would review once again the information about From the Wilderness, how to get it, where to get it. We can't give prices, of course, but and also phone, fax, website, etc.
Thank you, David. From the Wilderness, we publish 11 times a year, actually. Subscriptions get you 12 issues. We combine November, December. You can find us very easily on the web by going to www.copvcia.com. Think Roe v. Wade, but just make it copvcia.com. You can call us at 818-788-8791 during normal business hours. Someone will call you back. Anyone who subscribes tonight or who mentions Dave Emery's name gets four free issues, back issues for free. You can write to us at Post Office Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, and that's 91413. And we'll look forward to hearing from you.
All righty. And by the way, for the benefit of people who are hearing this live, this is going to be For the Record Program 192, this two-part interview. And once again, let me add that I think the From the Wilderness newsletter is not only a steal at any price, but it gets the Dave Emery five-star rating. Mike, congratulations, and I really am at a loss for superlatives about how to characterize your work. If you don't hold the Guinness World Book of Records for cojones, I don't know who does. And I just want to commend you for your bravery and your character. And you are the kind of American that we need more of in this country.
Well, thank you, David. I just kind of figured I was too dumb to quit a long time ago, and I'm too stubborn to change now.
Mm-hmm, and I'm too crazy to know the difference.
There you
so
go.
That, I guess, makes for a great team.
Yes, sir.
All righty. Well, we have been visiting with Mike Rupert, the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter, and a heroic crusader not only against governmental injustice, but in particular against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic. For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.